antenna, you have to accept the fact that with rare exception of that extremely well-documented design in that exact location with the exact materials, which we never have, we're going to have to do some tweaking of length to get it on the right frequency. We're going to have to do a little bit of tweaking of the impedance matching network at the base of the antenna or at the antenna tuner in order to make the standing wave ratio our favorite number at our favorite frequency. So whenever we're homebrewing an antenna, with rare exception, you have to accept the fact that you're going to do some measuring, you're going to do some tinkering, and it's not a showstopper, but I don't think I've ever built an antenna where I didn't have to tinker. And so I don't think you and I should lead these guys down the garden path and let them to believe that they build an antenna, it's going to work beautifully the very first time. We always have to tinker with antennas, is my belief. I wonder if that's somewhat similar to what you've encountered, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, now I just want to clarify the point that they won't have to make major changes. In other words, if they don't stick to like the experiment that Jerry Civic did with the television mast and the stainless steel whip, that let's say they use two pieces of television pipe, two 10-foot sections, or comes in 5-foot sections, use 3 5-foot sections, 15 feet, and then maybe use 3 feet of whip, that instead of 8 feet of whip, you say then that you don't think it's going to make much difference in the resistive component and the reactive component, that adjustment of the L networks that should be able to pull it into range, correct? Over.
Yes. Now, Jerry Civic is a good guy. He wrote some nice articles, reasonably well documented. As good a reference as Jerry's W2FMI's articles are, if Mel and Dick duplicated Jerry's antenna today with Jerry's exact materials in our particular backyard with our particular set of ground plane radials, I know that you and most likely I would be persnickety enough that we'd do a little bit of tweaking. The frequency wouldn't be quite right. The impedance match wouldn't be quite right. It'd be close enough. You're on the air. It's working. It's not a showstopper. It's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to blow up your rig. But if you'd like the VizWire on your favorite frequency to be as low as possible, you're going to do some tweaking of length and some readjustment of impedance matching if you have the ability to do that. And whether or not you use two pieces of pipe instead of one piece of pipe and whip and so on, you and I make those decisions primarily for mechanical reasons or because those are the materials I just happen to have right now and I feel like using them. We amateurs are very good at making substitutes, and 95% of the time the substitute works very well, because even if you didn't do the substitute, you're going to do some tweaking. When you do the tweaking, it's not a huge change, but even with the substitute, you're just going to do a little bit more tweaking. That's my guess, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Echo, sure.
Okay, hold it. What's the question? It's got to be on this subject. If it's not on this subject, please wait a minute. Be patient. If the person wants to ask a question about this subject, go ahead.
I heard Echo Sugar something. Is your question or comment on this subject, sir?
Yeah, this is KC2AE. I had a question, but that's okay. I'll take a standby. Let's go ahead and continue on. I'm sorry.
You got it, Mel.
Okay, while we're on the subject, there's another question that has come in from these people. Now, these are mostly fairly new people to amateur radio. It's a little bit, you know, foggy because, like you say, things like you see a taper and you look at the commercial version of these antennas. They're beautifully symmetrical, shiny types. Everything looks, you know, magnificent because they got the price. They got to get a price. I mean, you can't look at something that looks, you know, like, as you'd say, a homebrew project. It's got to look professional. So that's why these questions have come in, because these people look at the commercial version and then say, gee, mine looks awful, kind of what you would call, primitive. and it's just going to work. So that is why these questions are coming. Another question that has also come along with this thing, so that they don't understand when we were mentioning about degrees, antenna height in degrees. I guess I threw that in. Maybe I should have explained it more about Jerry, in his experiment, talked about the antenna, how it was mounted in height in degrees at that frequency. So can we go a little bit in and just break down simply height in degrees? Over.
Now that's an excellent subject, because I've been always forgetting about the fact that I'm telling people to look at the Brown and Woodward curves. They also are in degrees. You can talk about the length of an antenna in wavelengths. You can talk about the bottom of the antenna, or in the case of a dipole, the dipole is mounted at an altitude of some number of wavelengths. That's one system of units. Another system of units is degrees, and there's a one-to-one relationship between them most of the time. To a person who knows how to do conversion on sines and cosines, when some handheld calculators do it in radians, and some handheld calculators do it with degrees. 2 pi is one wavelength in the kind of calculator that does everything in radians, 6.28, or if you do it in degrees, it's 360 degrees. Most of us live nowadays in the degree world, so one wavelength. If I made a measurement for my antenna, and I start off with my sensing device touching the antenna, and I measure the phase angle and amplitude of the signal that I'm receiving. Let me drop. And I slowly take that sensing device that maybe is connected to a vector network analyzer, maybe it's connected to my fancy oscilloscope, whatever. I got the sensing device, and I start backing away from the antenna. And I'll notice that because my sensing device is a little bit of a distance away from the antenna, I know that the signal coming out of the antenna must experience a certain amount of time delay to get to my sensor. A time delay is distance, speed of light. When I back away one wavelength, and I'm measuring phase angle, I'll measure the time delay equal to one wavelength, and if I'm measuring degrees, I'll measure 360 degrees. 360 degrees is one wavelength. 180 degrees is a half wavelength. 90 degrees is a quarter of a wavelength. That's one way of looking at the relationship. I can decide I'm building a quarter wave monopole antenna, a vertical ground plane. I want it to be a quarter wavelength long. I can call it quarter wavelength. I can rate that in feet once I know what a wavelength is. I can rate it in degrees. I'll call it 90 degrees for a quarter wavelength. So length or altitude measured in degrees, 360 degrees is a wavelength. 180 is a half wavelength, 90 degrees is a quarter wavelength. I wonder if you think that's enough, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Yeah, that was really where I think we lost a lot of people. Because in the article of Jerry Civic, I had referred them to it, and he says the antenna he put it up was at approximately 46 degrees. Above ground. Now, they said, how did they get 46 degrees? What height is he talking? Well, he was talking about his roof where he installed this vertical for the experiment. So 46 degrees approximately on 40 meters would be approximately around 1/8 of a wavelength. So one eighth of a wavelength would, I guess, translate to the height about what? Around, 27 feet or 26 feet or whatever it is, comes out to that particular frequency. So again, make it simple. One wavelength would be 360 degrees. As Dick said, a half wavelength would be 180 degrees, and so on. So in the articles, a lot of them, yes, will tell you, when they talk about antennas, will go into wavelengths and height because they feel that, I guess it's an easier trade-off. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
The main reason why degrees are used is because it is a way of describing electrical length of the antenna. To a guy who's really got his hacksaw out and he's about to start cutting a piece of tubing and he's got a tape measure in his hand, he wants to know how many feet and inches he goes downrange if he's using imperial units in order to make the cut. But one of the nice things about antennas is that if I take any antenna on any particular band and I decide that I want to build the exact same antenna, but I want to build it at a frequency twice as high, with rare exception, if I scale every single dimension of the antenna on the new higher frequency by an exact relationship of wavelengths, I'll get the exact same antenna. If I'm building a 2-meter antenna, and this is the design, and that's roughly at 144 megacycles, and for some reason I want to build a satellite weather detecting antenna at 288 megacycles, twice the frequency, half the wavelength. If I take every dimension and divide by two, diameters, length, spacing, everything, I'll get the exact same antenna in theory, exact same performance. In the case of the 2-meter antenna, which was a quarter wavelength long, and I called it 90 degrees, and now I build the antenna at twice the frequency, 288 megacycles, I make it half the number of feet long, but I've doubled the frequency, the wavelength is half, it is still 90 degrees long for a quarter wave length of the radiator. So the nice thing about degrees is it's independent of what frequency you're on. As long as you know the frequency you care about, and therefore you can calculate the wavelength, degrees tells you how long make it for that frequency that you want to design it for. Because quite often we take somebody else's design and redesign it for our favorite frequency.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So you could have told me always make it a quarter wavelength long, or you could have told me always make it 90 degrees long for a conventional quarter wave ground plane antenna. That's part of the origin. And we always get a certain number of people on the website complaining about the fact that, gee, you guys are talking about the microwave frequencies and you're talking about the 70 centimeter band. Why the heck don't you call it the 432 megacycle band? Well, it's a tradition. In the old days, we used to measure what frequency we're on with Letcher wires. You would have these pair of wires side by side. You'd slide a short circuit across it and find the peaks and valleys with your neon bulb or with the short circuit measuring visual. You measured frequency by measuring wavelength. That's how it got started. We didn't have frequency counters in the old days. And now we've got both systems of units. We talk about the 20-meter band, or we talk about the 14-megacycle band. And if you're building a half-wave antenna on that band, in both cases it's 180 degrees long. You could say we've got three systems of units. And somebody should force us to use one universal set, but there's a lot of tradition involved here. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Very good. All right, so I think maybe that'll be a little bit easier to understand that. Because when you reference wavelength, and like you say, when you have that tape measure in your hand, you want to know how many feet and inches. So I guess that's what happened. You know, a number of the articles, that particular article, Jerry, did go into using degrees and most of the experiments of heights and everything of the antenna. So the easiest way I can say is to translate it over. Just remember that one wavelength, look in a book, one wavelength, that frequency you're on is a 360 degrees. If you want, you can divide it up from there. But you, like you say, Dick, there should be, I guess, a standard. I know we're jumping back and forth also from inches to millimeters and all, and a lot of articles get confusing in places like that. I guess the newcomers, it sounds completely erratic that we are doing all this, but like you say, part of it's tradition also in radio. Okay, so now, does anybody have any questions about any of this or above before we go any further? Okay. No question. So now, Dick, if you want, you can pick up another question, and we'll hold off everything else right now. At least this way I'll make some peace with this, because if I tell you that this week, close to a little over 200 comments this past week, over.
Hendricks here. NY2H with a question.
Okay, we've got N2XJN on the list, KC2A something on the list, and then NY2H in that order. Wesley, go ahead.
Hey, you're a Tesla coil and you have a bolt, the volt pump bolt in your hands, and you see the light. How do you measure the current on that particular bolt?
Yeah, most people, when they're using a Tesla coil and they want to see light, quite often they use a fluorescent tube. Is that what you're talking about, a fluorescent tube as the light that's being held near the Tesla coil? Wesley, go ahead.
No, I don't, but actually that does that's the similar subject. You can have a Wolfram-based bulb, and you can see that bulb leading. And the question is, how do you measure the current that is flowing through the bulb?
Okay, you said Voltron-based bulb, which maybe is a European standard that I'm not quite as familiar with. And maybe you're talking about an incandescent bulb that is lighting with a particular brilliance, and you want to know what current is flowing through that bulb, an incandescent filament bulb. Is that what you're asking, Wesley? Go ahead.
Wolfram is the metal. The Wolfram bulb is a typical bulb, the old-fashioned bulb. Back to you.
Okay, the way you're pronouncing that, Voltron, sounds like it is V-O-L-T-R-O-M. It sounds like it's an incandescent bulb. So I think you're saying you're using an incandescent bulb to measure current. That's a kind of a bulb that's got a filament that lights up, and you're looking at a particular amount of brilliance of that light, and you want to know what current that brilliance represents. Is that your question?
That is my question, but Wolfram is W-O-R-F-L-A-R-M.
Wow, that's a new one on me. Have you seen that word spelled out in literature in the United States, or have you seen that word spelled out in literature in Europe? Wesley, go ahead.
But a Wolfram material, it's the piece of the small small wire that is between these two rods inside the old-fashioned light box. That's the Wolfram that is being used. That's the kind of material that you see. Back to you.
Wolfram is tungsten.
Thank you very much for educating in this area.
Yeah, tungsten I've heard about, and the other set of words for it are not as popular in the United States, to my knowledge. Okay, there was an article in the Ham Radio Amateur's Handbook on this exact subject in the old days, and what the person did was to use a pair of identical bulbs side by side. One of them had the current flowing through it that was giving a certain amount of brilliance, and you wanted to know what that brilliance represented, how much current. The second bulb alongside of it was being fed from a battery and a potentiometer, and you adjust the potentiometer, the variable resistor, until the two bulbs had the identical brilliance. Then you measured the current with the DC circuit on the second bulb. See, measuring current at an RF frequency through a bulb is a good thing to do, but quantifying it is a little bit difficult. So using an identical bulb and getting the identical brilliance is one way of doing it. Trying to measure the voltage drop across that bulb at an RF frequency represents a bit of difficulty with instrumentation. That's a tough way to go. So let's hope that you've got a pair of tungsten filament bulbs essentially side by side. That's one possible approach that was described in the handbook. Back to you, Wesley, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely simple and brilliant. There's a comparison factor, you have the same amount of luxes, and then you can at least have some idea of what is the current of that light bulb. But the reason for the current is just to find out what is the power that is being consumed by the bulb. Back to you.
Yeah, the brilliance on the bulb represents a certain voltage drop. It represents a certain amount of current, and it is a relative power meter. If you're readjusting the tuning and loading control for a transmitter, and you adjust for maximum brilliance, you're probably adjusting for the best impedance match and the maximum amount of power into the antenna. But to use the bulb to quantify how much power is going into the antenna is a little bit difficult. You should be told, Wesley, that your particular power supply that you're feeding your rig with right now seems to have some hum on it, is my best guess as to what's happening. If you put your oscilloscope on that power supply while you're transmitting, you may see some hum because there's a little bit of scratchiness in your voice that seems to have a 120 cycle component to it. It's minor, but you might want to know about it. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, I have a number of devices that I can measure right now. 59 devices, or maybe already 60 devices. Yeah, but thank you very much for bringing that to my attention. I'm going to try to do it this way. I believe soon I'm going to be able to present you some very simple design that actually is capable of giving the light to an incandescent light bulb. When you take the voltage from the high voltage transformer and then you use two fast switching diodes connected to just one side of that transformer. One side of the transformer. The other side of the transformer is not connected. So we're talking about primary being fully connected and driven by the generator. From the other side, you have only one side of high voltage. To that side of high voltage, you have a two fast switching diode. One is in reverse. And these two switching diodes are connected to that wire. Now, between two other ends of these two diodes, you put the capacitor above 1 nanofarad. And then, between this this capacitor, you put that light bulb. And in the middle of that light bulb, you put just one coil of wire and the antenna. Or you can use that coil with one winding on it and connect it to the ground. I've tried. It works.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WB2HWW Dick. XJS does not have a power supply problem. He has multi-pamp. He sounds perfect on the input to the repeater.
That's exactly what I was about to tell him. When the repeater timed out, you sound beautiful on the input, hi-fi audio. But what's coming through the machine tonight is experience a kind of multipath, and there's a little bit of raspiness to your voice. So it looks like you're not causing it. Mother Nature is doing it. Now, what I think you're describing, let me drop.
Forget Luke.
I think what you're describing is a kind of a full-wave rectifier. And when you have a small antenna into a rectifying network, into a light bulb, or the ones that I built not too long ago used a very small, low-current, light-emitting diode, it becomes an RF sniffer. You put that on the end of a stick, a small antenna, this rectifying network of diodes and capacitor into a light-emitting diode, and now you can walk around some radio circuit with this circuit, and find out where the hotspots are, where the radiation is taking place. So maybe that's what you're describing, Wesley. And those are fun. RF sniffers are a lot of fun. And to have one that's thoroughly independent of test leads and an oscilloscope or a network analyzer, to have something that just lights up a light bulb. It's a tiny little circuit on the end of a stick that's in your hand, and it doesn't disturb the circuit that you want to know about. There are times when that gives you a lot of good information. N2XJN, K2RIW.
You remind me 30 years ago when I was much younger. I was doing this kind of experiments. It was fun. Well, actually, what is going on is the let's say you have a generator, and the generator is, instead of being powered from the power supply, it is being powered from 9-volt battery. Now, you're getting, let's say, $4,000. I'm sorry. 4,000 volts from the secondary of the transformer, and the primary is connected to the generator, and then only one end of the secondary is connected to two diodes, fast switching diodes, and these two diodes are connected in reverse, and between the ends of this two diodes, you put the 1 nanofarad capacitor, and then you connect to these two points, you put the connected incandescent light bulb. Now, in the middle of that light bulb, you make just one winding of the coil, and you can either connect it to any kind of wire creating an antenna, or you can connect it to the ground, and this light is going to give you the full bright light of 60 watts. Back to you.
Yeah, the nice thing about a Tesla coil is that the voltage is high enough that sometimes you only have to make one contact to one point, and the capacitance between there through your circuit to the rest of the universe provides the equivalent of the ground or the other terminal, and you can sense voltage. And it was that phenomenon, the fact that you only make one contact, not two contacts, and the circuit to some degree acts like it's complete. It is my guess that those kind of experiments are what influenced Mr. Nikola Tesla, and he said, hey, I can transmit power. If I can eliminate one of the wires with a little bit more work, I can eliminate both of the wires, and I can transmit power with no wires at all. And I think that's one of the paths that he was on, a very difficult path, by the way. And so when you start working with very high voltage circuits, very funny phenomena take place. I've been doing some study over the last couple of years of why does air break down at 30 volts per centimeter, 76 kilovolts per inch. Why does that break down air at normal pressure? And why does air break down at a much, much lower voltage, like one-tenth the voltage, if you go to a higher altitude? Or if you go to a higher air pressure, the voltage goes up instead of down. In other words, instead of 30 kilovolts per centimeter, it'll go to 60 kilovolts per centimeter at roughly 2 atmospheres. Why does air do that? Is air an insulator or a conductor? And here it's acting like neither one. It's like some other mysterious substance. And after some study, I think I understand that phenomenon. And I'm starting to study things at the molecular level. So I think that's what Tesla was into. Is that what you believe gave him the enthusiasm for his particular experiment? Back to you for a final for now, and then we'll come back a little bit later, Wesley.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
N2XJN, K2RIW.
There are two factors in here, N2XJN. One is psychological one, and the other one is just strictly scientific. Well, the first factor is very much needed in order to proceed with something, because you need the motivation. And that motivation, based on the history facts, actually end up in 1897 by the impact on the budget of Tesla from J.P. Morgan. Jacques? But, yes, well, that's what I'm pursuing, is free energy. And I'm pretty much convinced that it's going to just work. I believe that if Tesla had the amount of money that J.P. Morgan was able to provide for him, he would be actually speeding up everything that we see of today. Thank you very much for the chance talking to you about this area, and microphone back to you, and to share.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan had given him more funding, and if he was using modern instrumentation, would the result have turned out differently is an interesting question. Seeking free or apparently free energy or multiplied energy with magnetic rotary machines, a lot of people are pursuing that these days, a fun area, and a slightly controversial area, as you know. Lots of YouTubes are on that one. Okay, the next two people on the list were AC2A, I think it was, and then NY2H in that order. AC2A, and I meant to have your whole call letters. Give me your whole call letters slowly with your name, sir, and then proceed with your question or comment. K2RIW in the TechNet, my name is Dick. Maybe it was AC2ES. Okay, maybe not. Lou, NY2H, go right ahead, Lou.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everyone, and happy 4th of July to all. So I tuned in a little bit late. If anything I say has already been missed, just let me know very quickly. Just a couple of points. There were a couple of reports out in the news, one on cell phone safety, again, and tower safety, and apparently they did a report. It's in one of the British medical journals. They compared mothers that gave birth to babies that had some kind of brain cancer, and they looked at their locations, and there was no correlation in terms of proximity to cell phone towers. So that's number one. Another area is San Francisco passed a law where the cell phone stores now have to let you know what the radiation levels are of the cell phone. It's something called specific absorption rate, SAR. So I think that's already law there. So they want to give you that information. So you might want to comment on that. The other cell phone related is, had you heard about the iPhone 4 antenna problems? Apparently they have the cellular antenna, and then they have another antenna for GPS and Wi-Fi, and I think one other function, I don't recall, but apparently they meet at some point near the lower portion of the phone, and if your hand is on it, you may drop call and the signal, you detune the antenna apparently, so their suggestion is to get a case so that your hand doesn't go over that. So I wonder if you want to address any of those things. And the other thing, the original question I had was, Mel talks about the people inundating him with email. I'm just curious, is there an official email address? Because I can't find one on the website, and I never hear anybody say one. So these people are very resourceful, or I'm very I'm overlooking something. But so those are the few comments I have. Dick, go ahead.
Fantastic signal, Lou. To my knowledge, you live in Port Jefferson, and you're on the 2585 frequency tonight, and your signal is a gangbuster signal. Is that extremely good propagation? Are you using a zillion watts and a couple hundred feet of tower and a Yagi aimed at the repeater? Or is just the Mother Nature favoring you tonight? How come your signal from Port Jefferson is so strong tonight? That one first, Lou, go ahead.
I just fabricated this Tesla coil and got some free energy flowing into... No. I don't know. I'm going to have to credit it to Mother Nature. I'm normally in Medford on Sunday nights, but my lady friend is in Italy right now. So I'm home in Port Jeff, and I did put up a dual-band vertical antenna on the roof. So that's probably part of it, but you know, nothing special. I'm running a an ICOM 706, so I don't think the power's that great on there. So I'm probably fortunate. Mother Nature's probably playing nice tonight, but yeah, the antenna's worked out, so that's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I think Mother Nature is really smiling on you. I'm looking at the GPS map of your location right now, and I see you're not in the highest place in Port Jefferson, but you're certainly not down by the harbor, which is down at sea level. Mother Nature is really favoring you tonight. Beautiful signal. Okay, cell phone safety. That subject is not going to go away for the rest of our lives. It's going to be around, and it's a new technology, and people are afraid of it. They're afraid of the word microwave. They're afraid of the word RF radiation, and it's a repeat of history that's been done so many times before. Let me give you an example of that. When the lighthouse for the United States Capitol was first electrified with electrical light bulbs, they hired people to turn on and off the light switches at dawn and dusk, and those people were given hazardous duty pay to operate the light switches. And not too many years downrange from there, people were worried that you must always plug a light bulb into a light circuit, because if the light bulb wasn't plugged in, the electricity would leak out of that socket and it would damage your health. People used to believe that. When electricity was first starting to be used, it was a brand new technology and people were afraid of it. Well, we're running through a rather similar thing now with cell phone radiation. When you study the inverse square law, and if you assume that the cell site is transmitting, let me pick a number, 40 watts, and if you buy the house that's directly next door in the worst case town, the closest you can get to that antenna is about a 200 foot range because of its altitude and because of the property lines and whatever. When you're in your house, you're at least 200 feet away. And yes, it's running 40 watts, and that cell phone in your hand on average is running, let me pick a number, 100 milliwatts. And one is 400 times greater than the other. So obviously the cell site with that 100 foot high piece of hardware, it's 30,000 pounds of hardware, great big steel structure with a zillion antennas on top, and a little building down at the bottom with all kinds of fancy looking equipment. Let me drop. Obviously that's the source of danger, that great big piece of hardware. That $500,000, $250,000 installation, that little cell phone in your hand that you can, with some services you can buy for $20, that can't possibly be dangerous. Well, it's the other way around. Inverse square law, because of the 200 foot of range versus the quarter inch of range or half inch of range between the cell phone antenna and your head. Under most circumstances, the cell phone radiation from the cell phone to your head is 1 million times greater than if you lived directly next door to the cell phone base station. Well, somebody's going to come back and say, yeah, but the cell phone base station runs 24 hours a day. I only use my cell phone 5 minutes a week. Yeah. It's still a million to one power ratio. Now, yes, when San Francisco tells you, so to worry about the cell sites themselves is crazy, but it's good common sense. You stand in front of a zoning board and you tell them the cell site is a million times safer than the cell phone. The cell phone weighs a couple of ounces, and the cell site is thousands of pounds, and hundreds of feet, and kilowatts of power going into the room at the bottom, and so on. They say, what planet are you on? They don't understand the physics of the inverse square law. Now, I'm not saying that cell phones are dangerous. All I'm saying is they're a million times stronger. Now, when it comes to the specific absorption rate, there's a couple of websites you can go to where you can look at a list of about 250 separate cell phone brand names and models, and they write down the specific absorption rate you're going to get from each one of those, which represents, in theory, a real measurement that was done most of the time, and hopefully done with reasonable accuracy. A smarter person will realize that the amount of real estate you're putting into an 800 megacycle or a 1900 megacycle antenna inside of that cell phone is so small, it has no capability within the reasonable laws of physics to create any directivity. you work real hard and you mount the antenna in point A, point B, or point C within the cell site, within the cell phone, you can make a difference of a dB or two of front-to-back ratio. How much goes toward your body versus how much goes out into space. You'd love to have a 20 decibel front-to-back ratio and aim all the signal into space away from your body. You don't have the real estate. You don't have the resources. The physics won't let you do it. So therefore, all of the
S-A-R-Y-O.
Oh, and Bernie recognized. Therefore, all of these SAR ratings really represent what is the power output of that cell phone. You can buy one with a low SAR rating if you want. 90% of what you're buying is just simply a lower power output, which means it's not going to have as much range. That's the trade-off in that area. Let me break off on the four subjects. I've sort of touched on two of them so far. Bernie, I think you want to make a comment on this. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Sorry for interrupting, Dick, but just a question you can probably fill in. Is there a federal limit to the SAR that a cell phone can emit? And if there is, wouldn't it be logical to say that all of them probably emit the same amount, that being the maximum? The reason I bring this up, I had to buy a microwave oven this afternoon, and everybody has the same wattage. I assume that's probably a limit as to how much power they can use. Therefore, everybody comes out with the same wattage. Wouldn't the cell phones also have the same SAR?
The United States standard is 1.6 watts per kilogram, measured across a particular gram of human material. In other words, you make the measurement per square centimeter, but it's in units of watts per kilogram, and it's 1.6 watts in the United States. I think England is 2 watts per kilogram, and yes, they all meet that. You go to that website that lists the 150 model numbers and brand names, and the worst case one there goes to a 1.45 or 1.52, something like that, on a spec that, as I remember, is 1.6 watts you're allowed. They chose the 1.6 watts per kilogram as the approximate number of power flux density watts, which gives you something like 1/10 of 1 degree, I think it's Fahrenheit, of heating of human tissue. I think it's 1/10 of a degree Fahrenheit of heating. Is now 1/10 of a degree Fahrenheit of heating going to create damage? I highly doubt it. And that's for a continuous rating. If the cell phone was at maximum power and you sat there continuously for 6 solid minutes and wait for all the heating to take place. The human body, most of the portions of the human body have a thermal time constant of roughly 6 minutes. That's the reason why the American National Standard Institute standard rates power flux density in watts per kilogram or milliwatts per square centimeter. You've got various systems of units, but in all of those systems of units, in theory, you're supposed to integrate for 6 solid minutes. So yes, they all meet it. So you can buy the cell phone that's got the lower SAR rating, and you walk out of the store in San Francisco and you say, hey, I'm happier. I bought a safer phone, and now I can let my children use it. It's a good sounding theory. You've just bought a lower power output cell phone, which is going to have less range.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
It doesn't have the capability of... Somebody wants to make a comment? It doesn't have the ability to have any significant front-to-back ratio, any real directivity. The resources are not there, and we're all demanding our cell phones get smaller and smaller, therefore the problem's getting worse and worse. Now, when it comes to the iPhone 4, yes, when Steve Jobs first announced that cell phone, I guess it was the third week in April, and he talked about the geniuses that designed the antenna into the perimeter, and he probably did a minor amount of testing in his development laboratory, which has a AT&T site right outside of his building. Therefore, there was a whopping big signal, and he could have put the thing inside of a screen room, and it still would have made a cell phone call because the cell site is so close. So he had no chance to find out that putting the hand on the antenna and that gap you're talking about is the two halves of the dipole, so to speak, for the wide area network antenna. And so when you put your hand across a dipole right on the metal, you create a tremendous amount of dielectric loading of the antenna. You tune it to another frequency, and of the energy it's trying to emit, a high percentage of it is being absorbed by your hand, and you're presenting a really yucky impedance match to the transmitter inside, and therefore it's putting less energy into the antenna. So you lose three ways. High vis-wah, the antenna, the transmitter is not putting out as much power. What power it puts out, a high percentage of it you're absorbing, and you're tuning the antenna to some other frequency. Other than that, it works like a charm. There's a pun in there somewhere. And yes, when you put the boot around the antenna, around the iPhone 4, you're now creating a dielectric spacing, a airspace between your hand and the antenna, and the performance improves considerably. And Steve Jobs did, on April 23rd, issue a request for 3 antenna engineers with cell phone experience. He's got a great big long list of requirements. They must have all kinds of knowledge about all of the European, American, and other standards for cell sites, for cell phones. They must have all of this experience in all of these areas to help him design antennas for portable handheld devices, as the way it's described. It's overly obvious that he's looking for cell phone antenna engineers. He quite possibly farmed out that portion. He outsourced that portion of the development, is a good guess. And he's not happy with the results, and now he wants to do it locally. That's a guess on my part as to what I think is going on. Now, Mel, to answer Lou's question about how do people find your email address in order to send you an email, you maybe don't want to announce that over the air. That's your choice. And how do you think they've done it? That was Lou's question. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. Here, I got it. Okay, this is K2KEY. You want to send me an email? Well, very easy. K2KEY, ARRL.net. And, I have gotten, as I said, quite a number this week, and a lot of phone calls, Dick, over.
Yeah, let's be a little bit clear about this one. Mel forgot to tell you a very important factor, and that is Mel and I have volunteered for years and years now. This is year number 27 and a half of this particular TechNet. And we have volunteered to give people verbal answers live over the air on this particular TechNet. And if you think that Mel and Dick are volunteering to give you free consulting service in written form, well, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn I want to sell you if you think that's what we're volunteering for. Mel gets hundreds of emails. The majority of the ones that he's able to answer are the brand new people who would like to get into ham radio. And they're asking logical questions because they can't yet get on the air. They have found us with their scanner, and they said, gee, these guys with ham radio and the TechNet, they're having a grand old time. I want to join that. I want to get a license. So for the brand new guys, Mel will answer a certain number of those. And if you think that you're going to get free consulting service, and some of these people will send Mel emails where they want him to solve their college electrical engineering homework for him. I don't blame the guy for asking. He thinks he's hearing some smart people. He's going to get some answers. But that's not what we volunteered for. So you're taking a risk. You can send an email. If you fall out of that range of what we've decided to answer, the answers from the people who are trying to get into electronics for the first time in their life. But if you're outside of that purview, and if you think you're going to get free consulting service, you can send your email if you like. There is no guarantee you're going to get an answer. You're taking that risk, because that's not what we volunteered for. This particular TechNet has already run for something like 3,500 hours of live question and answer.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Of live question and answer and people helping each other, a gathering of the clan type stuff. But my typing speed is 1/120th of my speaking speed, if you know what I mean. So I'm not volunteering to do that. So maybe these are some of the answers you're looking for, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, sir. Very good. You covered them all. And I go away satisfied, my friend. Thank you. Back to you.
Yeah, this cell phone radiation jazz is going to go on for years. The most serious case I know of is the one that's going on now for 3 solid years in Bayville, Long Island. Bayville, Long Island consists of something like 7,000 residents, 3,000 homes, I think it is, in that order. And essentially the majority of that town has come to the conclusion that the one single cell site in that town is issuing cancer. It is damaging their children. This is their belief. And they have 3 separate parallel lawsuits running right now, suing their town government and suing the cell site owner, saying that these cell sites must be, the cell site, singular, must be removed from that village, the village of Bayville, Long Island. And they also want the antennas removed that are on the water tower that are being used by the police department, the fire department, emergency vehicle dispatching, ambulance services. They want those antennas put in some other town. And even before this lawsuit came along, the people who are volunteer firemen in that town were complaining that the antennas for fire dispatching only have 85% coverage in the town. The town fathers did hire a consulting service that found out that the law enforcement antennas only have 85% coverage. In theory, a law enforcement person or a policeman in that town must memorize all the places where his police radio doesn't work. Otherwise, he's in danger in those areas. He doesn't have the ability to holler Mayday, officer being fired upon. He can't even call his headquarters from those other 15% places. And depending on how you talk to, the 15% estimate of the places where it doesn't work, it's either a conservative or a non-conservative estimate. So I know that the
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I know that the Department of Homeland Security will not allow the removal of those antennas. I know that the county government, the state government, the federal government will not allow that. I know that a lot of money is being spent, a lot of nerves are being frayed, a lot of unhappiness is coming, and it's all because of a misunderstanding. These people are very serious. They are sincere. They really believe that they're protecting their children. The people in the town of Bayville have elected to stop using microwave ovens, to stop using cell phones. They don't use the PCMCIA card in their laptop computer when the child is in the house for fear that the signal coming out of that, the RF radiation, is damaging to their children. They have that degree of sincerity. They're willing to give up those appliances for that protection for their children. It's all because of a vocabulary problem, in my opinion. In other words, had we called it radio signaling and radio communication, we wouldn't have had this problem. Because it's called RF radiation, and it sounds like nuclear radiation, very, very different, but it sounds like it, the residents have convinced each other in that particular village that this is a danger that must be removed from their community. I wonder if you've heard about any of this before, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Debate 2RIY.
Okay, RIY, recognized. Yes, I have, and in fact, one of the managers at work is a resident, and he probably fits the profile of some of the people of which you speak. So, because he's got some power over me in the workplace, I do not get into that debate with him. But, you know, I know that you've been involved. I think you've offered testimony. So, he commented. He was at some of those meetings. So, yeah. But, you know, like you say, it's, there's a mindset, and I don't think they want to be confused by the facts. And one other quick topic I know that you've talked about. Let me just drop it a second, and then you can turn over to the other station. Just hold on one sec. We talked a lot in the past, you did, about the Toyota problem. Seems to have gone away. You know much about it. I had an incident with my car. I have a Hyundai. And apparently it was a failure of the same system, except in the Hyundai it's a fail-safe. It puts you into something called limp home mode, where the engine won't go above idle. And when I brought it in and they swapped out some computer equipment, I believe, or not quite sure exactly what they swapped out, but the service representative did say that, yeah, it's the same problem generally, except that they fail safe. Over to you, Dick, NY2H.
Yeah, in the case of Toyota automobiles, there is significant records. You can go to the right website and look at those records, where the number of vehicle runaway conditions was happening significantly since 1998 on Toyota Corolla, I think it is, among other models, and Lexus and so on. And very similar to the problem that Audi had in 1985, runaway fly-by-wire computer systems on the engine. And what Audi did was to change the computer program so that when you touch the brake, no matter where the gas pedal is set, the engine must be commanded into idle mode when your foot is on the brake. Because there seems to be a huge drop in the number of complaints on Toyota automobiles, and they claim that they're fixing the gas pedal, but I suspect during that repair there's also a change in the computer programming, such that this what you call fail-safe mode, foot on the brake, engine must be in the idle mode in order to avoid this problem. Very dangerous otherwise. And by the way, when it comes to Bayville, they now have a website called BRACT, Bayville Residents Against Cell Towers. You go to that website, and every single report that anyone has ever written that talks about radio radiation in a negative manner, every single one of those articles are gathered in one place. Every one of the articles that say anything else are not on that website. So I suspect it's not an objective gathering of data, but it certainly is a significant gathering of data. And if you have a mindset to think that, let me drop. You have a mindset to believe that this is a dangerous condition, to have cell site and police and fire and ambulance antennas in your town. If you have that mindset and you go to that website and you believe those particular reports, your belief will be strengthened. But in my opinion, it's not objective. I'm reasonably sure it's in error. But lots of money and lots of anguish is going to be spent. I'm reasonably sure it's a relatively futile effort. To say you're going to put the antennas in some other place, there is no other place. To put them in some other town means you're giving up those communication services. And those services represent life and death. Those various agencies won't let you do that. That's my belief as to what's going to happen. Joe, W-H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-I-W on the TechNet.
Hazard signal strength, Benny. Okay, VHF or not?
You're 50% noise, Joe. Go ahead.
All right, let me try coming in from IRLP. Is this a little better?
Now you're 3% noise. Sound good.
Okay. I've been listening to you talk on this particular subject about the cell site stuff in Bayville, on and off. This is what I have to say about this. There was a story I heard a few years ago, whatever, maybe I mentioned on this tech or not. I never heard the outcome of the story. But it was about a woman and her husband went off the road up on the thruway, upstate New York. I don't know, not too far upstate New York, but, reasonable. And they had no cell site coverage. And the husband ended up dying because they could not get, help in time. I don't know what the final outcome of that story ever was, if somebody was able to do what the town because they were the instrument that prevented the cell site from being put up on town property. Now, of course, I think they're put up on state property, so it's sort of like, you know, took care of that problem.